thanks so much for having me here. I'm really glad to be a part of the panel and the panelists, to learn from them as well. So I'm an organizer with CWA Canada and our largest local, which is the Canadian Media Guild. We're the country's only all-media union, so we represent workers at Vice Canada, which is most relevant to this discussion, CBC, Corus Entertainment, the Canadian Press, APTN, TVO, and newspapers and other media outlets across the country. So I want to use this time to just kind of share my reflections on my experience and the experiences of my colleagues organizing in the digital media sector over the last couple of years. And I'm also going to draw on what's been happening in the US, where a lot of the digital media organizing has been going on, both with our sister union, which is the News Guild. We're both part of the Communication Workers of America, and the Writers Guild of America East. So I think overall it's been a really exciting time for workers in the media. We've seen successful drives in Canada. Our own union worked on Vice Canada. And in the US, there's been Vice, Gawker, Huffington Post, Salon, Think Progress, MTV News, and a few more. And in total, about 1,000, I'd say, digital media workers have joined unions in the past couple of years. The contracts that are being negotiated, and quite a few are still in process, but the ones that have been negotiated have high pay increases, protections for editorial independence, health benefits, severance pay, and other provisions that are turning these companies into places where there is high turnover, lots of precarity, to places where you can actually build a career. And yeah, this is a really refreshing change in the media industry, where labor practices have recently been including the use of unpaid interns, taking advantage of freelance workers through low pay or even no pay contracts, or by taking months and months to pay freelance invoices, misclassifying employees as independent contractors to avoid paying things like CPP, benefits, EI, and generally relying on low pay and temporary labor. For too long, it's been an industry that's taken full advantage of the uncertainty and fear created by the ongoing changes in the media and the fact that it is a desirable place to work. Workers entering the industry through unpaid internships are given the message that because they're doing what they love, what they're passionate about, they shouldn't worry about the pay or the conditions of the work. Employees misclassified as independent contractors and workers stuck on perpetual short-term contracts are told that they're lucky to be working in the industry and that there's lineups of people waiting outside if they're not okay with the terms of employment. So I've been working with interns, students, and freelancers for the past few years, and I've seen them fighting back against these ideas that have really normalized exploitation in the media. Interns at The Nation magazine in 2011 collectively demanded to be paid a living wage for their work, and they won. Within our own union, we have an associate membership program for interns and students, and they got our union to adopt model collective agreement language to better protect interns, and have now implemented a program to welcome interns into the union and inform them of their rights. We've also supported freelancers who have collectively refused to sign rights-grabbing contracts, who are fighting back against and exposing publishers who don't pay, and who have refused to cross and instead stand on the picket line with their colleagues at the Halifax Chronicle Herald, which is one of our locals that's currently on strike for over the past year. We also have a campaign with workers in the factual TV industry who are mostly independent contractors, or at least engaged as independent contractors, and about 500 of them have signed a card to be represented by the guild. So it may be that this growing sense of injustice and collective action taken by these most precarious segments of the media industry helped to encourage employees at digital media workplaces to also take a stand. In the past couple of years, workers and largely non-union, but quickly growing online part of the media industry have also started building their power through collective action. So these are workers with jobs that actually come with a steady paycheck. There are companies where people generally do want to work. They often articulate this as, you know, they're places where they feel they have the freedom to write the stories that they want in the ways that they want. So why this sudden surge in unionizing in this industry? So I'm going to go through a couple of the main reasons that I've seen. So first is that I think workers realize that, you know, they're the ones who make these companies successful, and they were sick of being told that they should just feel lucky for simply getting to work in the industry. As one Vice Canada worker wrote during our organizing drive, he said, "Our work, our stories, our time, ourselves. That's what makes Vice a powerhouse. Despite Vice trading on individual employees' talents, skills, and finely tuned spidey senses, we don't often see a return in a material sense. So at the same time, these workers realize that the companies they work for are no longer these small, spunky startups, but multi-billion-dollar companies, often with a sizable profit. And when they start to look around at the lavish offices, the hundreds of staff across the globe, and well-paid executives, they started having real expectations for how they should be treated. They wanted a living wage, and workplace policies that ensured fair treatment for all, and the possibility of building an actual career. So not surprisingly then, in many of the organizing drives, one of the major demands so far has been fair pay. So both setting out pay scales, but also just pay increases, so like fair way to distribute the pay, but also pay increases. Many of the digital media companies are in Toronto and New York, some of the most expensive cities in each of their countries. And yet they were paying wages that made it hard to pay the rent, to afford food, let alone pay off student debt and raise a family. So through building power and collectively negotiating, digital media workers have won major pay increases. Just to give you some examples, at Think Progress, in the first year of the contract, almost a third of the bargaining unit received increases between 9 and 20%. At Vice US, they won 29% increases over the first 3 years of the contract. And at Gawker, they raised the minimum salary to $50,000 a year. So these are wages that actually make it possible to build a sustainable career in the media and that will encourage workers to stick around for the long term. So this relates to another, what I've seen is another major motivation behind many of the digital media campaigns. So beyond just pay and benefits, which are of course important, but workers wanted protections in their contracts to ensure that they could continue to do in-depth critical reporting that's so necessary, that media plays that role in our society. So a major demands were around the quality of the work that they could produce. So to give you an example, at MTV News, workers announced that their organizing drive shortly after the US election, and their public statement was really framed around the quality of the work they could do. So they said, a quote from their public statement was, "There has never been a more critically important time in our lives to have the protections of a union, especially in the media." And so their demands, yeah, were directly around their ability to tell the stories that they felt needed to be told. So they include legal protections so they can report without fear of retribution, a system for workers to take part in creating the editorial policy so that they can write stories without fear of influence, and a clear process in place to provide concrete opportunities to people of color to advance at the company and to increase the amount of diverse MTV News hires throughout all levels. So just to explore some of that a bit more, I think policies to ensure diverse newsrooms was a central feature in many of the negotiations. Some of the contracts outline mentorship programs, job posting policies, and the establishment of diversity committees. And I think this reflects an understanding that the quality of reporting is inseparable from the question of who gets to tell the stories and what stories are told. Also, including an article on editorial independence was also a priority in many of the negotiations. This is especially important in an industry that's always innovating new ways to generate revenue to keep the companies growing. And my sense is that workers, you know, understand that this is a necessity and they don't have a problem with things like in-house ad agencies, in the case of Vice, or native and branded content and other unique marketing strategies, but they do want a clear separation between what's ad and what's journalism. As an example, at Huffington Post, editorial independence is one of the first things that they signed off on in their negotiations, and it was really spurred on by an incident where an editor at the site had killed a story pitch that was unfavorable to Uber right after a partnership between the two companies had been signed off on. Also at the time, Arianna Huffington was still at Huffington Post, and she had just taken a seat on the board of Uber. So protecting the quality of the work through editorial independence, policies, legal protections, and initiatives to create spaces for journalists from marginalized backgrounds were integral demands throughout all of the campaigns. And then finally, in terms of why people are organizing in the sector, something else I've noticed is that some of the unions were formed at very small, kind of progressive organizations where working conditions, by and large, were pretty all right. And in these cases, workers were motivated by, I think, four different things instead of this. Well, maybe in addition to the things I mentioned. But the first was the idea that they just wanted to secure the good working conditions that they already have. This is a time where there is money in digital media, but it's also a rapidly changing industry where things aren't secure. And, you know, they realize that the only way to ensure that the benefits continue is if they form a union and put these into a collective agreement. The second reason is that I really saw in, you know, a lot of the public statements was that they wanted a formal channel to have input in workplace decisions. One of the key demands throughout many of the drives was to just gain a greater say in the workplace, and joining a union was about changing the structure of the workplace so that management no longer had control over how things are run, or complete control, I guess. So just one little example is in Gawker, they negotiated so they have a monthly meeting between management and workers where they talk about what's going on in the workplace. The third reason why these types of workers have joined unions is to hold their employers accountable to their stated progressive values. So this is true of places like Think Progress or The Root and Salon, where workers have framed their organizing drive as asking these companies to live up to the values that they espouse. So at Jacobin, a left-leaning publication, the workers wrote, quote, "We didn't decide to organize because we were all suffering under the crushing heel of management. Jacobin is a very egalitarian place and it's relatively young. But the values we are putting forward and that workers deserve a say in their working conditions and a formal structure to pursue such things is of a piece with the larger politics of the magazine." It's also strategy. If you draw on that, it makes a very nice case publicly about why you want to form a union. It's holding management to account. And the last reason why workers at generally kind of well-run progressive outlets wanted to form a union is that they wanted to join a growing movement to lift standards across digital media. And unions have, of course, played a historically very strong and important role in this industry. But in recent years, standards have been eroding with the rise of unpaid work and low freelance rates and the growing number of non-union workplaces. So I think workers are now unionizing, who are unionizing now, are playing an important role in lifting standards across the industry. And it's not about each individual workplace, but it's an industry-wide movement. And I do find this heartening because it really counters the idea that everyone in the media has been conditioned to think individualistically about their career ambitions. These workers are sending a clear message that they've rejected the idea that the only way to get ahead is by undercutting their peers and building their individual brand. Instead, they're turning to building collective power and using that to raise standards for all media workers. So, just the last thing I want to talk about a bit is the actual, what's the process of organizing digital media workplaces. And just to start off, I think, you know, in many ways, the union campaigns that have happened at digital media workplaces really do resemble any other organizing drive. They came down to having a strong inside committee made up of workers at those workplaces who really led the campaigns, and countless hours of one-on-one meetings. But between CMG's, the Canadian Media Guild's experience at Vice Canada, and what I've learned in talking to other US organizers, I think there's a few common elements that are worth noting. So one is that there was really broad support for the union across many of these workplaces. At Salon and The Root, all of the employees there signed union cards. At Fusion, 90% of them voted in favor of a union, and at The Guardian US, they voted unanimously in favor of a union. So these are pretty high numbers that I think reflect the level of member engagement. Most of the campaigns actually started when the workers, already self-organized, came to the union to ask for support. The organizing committees themselves were large, representative of the workplace, and active. So they were really the ones doing the work to outreach their colleagues and have the conversations. At Vice Canada, there were workers involved from nearly all departments. So it was the editorial employees that actually first came to us, who were first interested in forming a union, but they quickly realized that they'd be able to build more power if the union contract covered the whole workplace. So in the end, the certificate from the Labor Board includes all departments, production, editorial, post-production, even the ad agency staff, operations, IT, accounting, and more. Most of the campaigns have also drawn on tactics that make use of the social media and communication skills that the employees have and that really reflect the workplace culture. So Gawker was the first company to unionize, and they actually posted a public article on their website about why employees were thinking of forming a union. Their union, which is the Writers Guild of America East, didn't force the campaign to go public, and it's not usual for an organizing campaign to go public so early on in the process. but it's what works in this context and that you need to get in the way. The employees ended up having this rigorous online discussion and they decided to form a union. And I think the public nature of this debate actually helped encourage other workers at other digital media companies to start thinking about a union. In contrast, the Vice Canada campaign took many months to build quietly in the workplace. But once the cards were filed, we also used social media to build momentum going into the vote. So a key moment of the campaign was when we drew on our connections, the US labor movement, to get Bernie Sanders to tweet his support for Vice Canada workers. It was actually kind of fun. We were sitting around trying to think of like who would be the, you know, who would be someone famous that Vice Canada workers would actually be excited to hear from. And it worked because they were suddenly workers who weren't engaged in the campaign publicly now felt comfortable, you know, talking on Twitter about the union. And just finally, I think a really important aspect of these campaigns is the multinational kind of nature, because the companies themselves operate across the globe. And at Vice Canada, many of the editorial employees actually collaborate daily with their Vice US counterparts. And I think, yeah, the strength of the campaign was using these cross-border connections to build momentum. So at Vice Canada, throughout the card signing phase, the organizing committee would meet with the organizing committees of Vice US and Vice UK in the middle of their campaigns. So they shared information about what was happening in the workplace, what management was doing, tactics that were successful, and generally boosted each other's confidence that they're not alone in the fight. There was many concrete acts of solidarity. Vice Canada workers sent Vice UK workers a basket of chocolate at one point to boost morale. UK workers sent us testimonials to use in leaflets. And US members were even invited to speak via Skype at a membership meeting of Vice Canada workers to share their experience of the bargaining and how forming a union had helped improve the workplace environment. So this exchange of information and acts of solidarity have continued into the bargaining phase, and it makes each of these unions stronger. And it's also been exciting to see, now that many of these contracts are now being bargained, the high levels of member engagement continue into this phase too. And just one quick example is that at Huffington Post, management, after months of negotiating, handed over a proposal with no raises. And members at that point decided to take to Twitter. Many of them went on Twitter to publicly denounce their employer, you know, saying, as one example, they tweeted an article called AOL owns Huffington Post. AOL CEO is getting $59 million bonus this year. And they said, you know, our company won't negotiate on pay, we'll provide no raises. Some coworkers take two jobs to pay rent, but just last year, and then linked to that article. And within weeks, they had an agreement where members got raises between $10,000 and $20,000 a year, most of them. So I'll wrap up here, but just leave you with the thought that, you know, it has been really exciting to see these workers starting to organize in digital media. But I think the strength of the effort will depend on the ability for workers to continue to organize, to build enough power in the workplace to actually win good contracts and enforce them, and to link their campaigns to ongoing industry-wide efforts to improve working conditions for all workers.